Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Getting caught in the wrong shoes can interrupt your plans for the day, like when that 10% chance of rain ends up looking more like 100%. When the transition to fall and winter feels more like experiencing every season on the same day, there's the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. These shoes were made for misty morning walks, surprise snow days, and anything a trip to the dog park might bring. The whole collection brings together water-repellent technology and classic style, so you can stay warm, dry, and comfy during your everyday adventures. Cross off errands with the splash protection on the Wool Runner Mizzle. Dash through cold and wet weather with all-conditioned traction and reflective details on the Wool Dasher Mizzle. Or upgrade to next-level protection with the Mudguard on the Wool Runner-Up Mizzle Plus. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code FRESHSOCKS.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Hidden Histories. So today I had Hallie Rubenhold back on the podcast to talk about her book, The Five, The Untold Lives of the Women Killed by Jack the Ripper. Hallie has had so much success with this book, and quite rightly so. She says herself, the victims of Jack the Ripper were never just prostitutes. They were daughters, wives, mothers, sisters and lovers. They were women, they were human beings. Hallie amazingly brings light to this cult, this myth of Jack the Ripper, and actually the truth behind the women's lives and the women who were killed by him in such a brutal circumstance. Hallie's a social historian, and her expertise really does lie in revealing the stories of previously unknown women. And The Five has changed the narrative of these murders forever. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Hallie goes into so much detail about her research and about the women whose voices have been previously unheard. Hallie Rubenhold, welcome back to Hidden Histories.
Hi, nice to be back.
You're my first return guest, but I think this particular podcast is going to be the big one. And this is actually the subject that you were working on at the time that we recorded the first one.
That's right. And so I think we're going to have an opportunity to really talk about all of those things, which I didn't really go into much detail about when we spoke for the first time.
So congratulations, because The Five, The Untold Lives of the Women Killed by Jack the Ripper, has been so successful. I mean, it feels like every single week you're getting another nomination or another prize, and you had the huge event winning the Bailey Gifford Prize last year. Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, and I've been shortlisted for the Wolfson Prize in History.
You have, and very so well deserved, because I think that this book was a long time coming, really, for the subject of history as a whole. I think just this telling of women's history and the addressing of women's lives in the way that you have is so important. And that's kind of what I want to talk to you about a lot within this podcast. So firstly, I mean, I think the key question is, before we start talking about the women, why have these women received no scholarly attention or even popular attention before you began to research their lives?
Well, I think there are lots of reasons for this. I mean, obviously, Jack the Ripper has been a focus of so much attention. You know, I mean, literally libraries of books have been written about the subject. And it's always been positioned kind of as a whodunit. So the main concern has been trying to figure out who Jack the Ripper was. It's become almost like a sort of parlor game. And part of a cultural legend. And that has something to do with it, because the whole concept of Jack the Ripper is something which has become almost entangled in fiction. It's been so mythologized that we cease to think of it really as either a legitimate field of study or as anything that actually was real or had repercussions for people. Jack the Ripper and the Whitechapel murders have been studied, first I want to say, in some detail amongst cultural historians. But actually picking apart the historical events has not really been considered. It's also been thought to be quite a fringe interest. So it's something which, you know, like, unfortunately, things like the Kennedy assassination and, God forbid, you know, the Loch Ness Monster, you know, somehow goes into this realm of, you know, conspiracies / supernatural. And so, therefore, it's not really been taken seriously by anyone. And, you know, and it's just those sorts of areas that deserve scholarship and scholarly attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right, everybody is familiar with Jack the Ripper. I think even from, you know, primary school age, it's become this myth and a whodunit. And gosh, it's become like a fantasy for so many. But you're right, the women haven't really been, I mean, they haven't really been addressed at all. But who were they? Who were the women that were killed by Jack the Ripper?
Well, I think, you know, as you say, you know, it's important that we know who they are. And obviously we know his name. His name, sadly, is a household name. But we don't know who they are. And that in itself should give us really pause. So their names are Polly or Marianne Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Jane Kelly. And the interesting thing, well, there are many interesting things about these women, but most people don't realise that they are not the Hollywoodised images that we have of them in our minds. They were, when they were killed, mostly women in their 40s, with the exception of Mary Jane Kelly, who was around 25 when she died. These women did not come from Whitechapel, and they ended up there at the end of their lives. They had very long lives and lots of life experience. They were mothers, they were sisters, they were wives, they were partners, they were friends. And they had people who loved them also. And they came from very different backgrounds. So, for example, Elizabeth Stride actually came from Sweden. Catherine Eddowes came from Wolverhampton. Mary Jane Kelly came from Wales. Annie Chapman lived on a country estate with her husband. He was a coachman before she ended up in Whitechapel. Polly Nichols was the wife of a printer. You know, their stories are surprising. They also are very much part of working class history and women's history in the 19th century. And that's another reason why they haven't really had a look in, because as we know, history tends to be written by the victors, and history focuses quite a lot on the people with power and not on the dispossessed, which they were.
So what do you think connected these women to their ultimate fate? And I'm not going to say that being at the hands of Jack the Ripper, but more the sort of harsh reality of the Victorian London's poor community. I mean, with all of these disparate backgrounds, what do you think drew them together to Whitechapel?
Well, it was a failure of society, really. I mean, women were considered second-class citizens. I mean, obviously, women had very few rights. Even if you were a woman, you know, born into wealth and title, you still couldn't vote. You know, that's just one example. But really, society was geared entirely towards not allowing women to be on an equal footing with men in any way. So, for example, women's work didn't pay as much. Women couldn't enter into the professions. It was basically believed that a woman's job was to be a wife and a mother. That was her designated role. There was no other purpose for her in life. And so society wasn't geared around enabling women to support themselves. For example, if their male partner or husband left them, if their father died and they had to become the main breadwinner, you know, it was very, very difficult to survive. And also society had a lot of expectations about female behaviour. So, for example, why it wasn't necessarily thought of as proper for men to have a lot of sex outside of marriage, it was certainly thought of as normal and natural, whereas a woman who had sex outside of marriage was damaged goods, and that was because obviously women could get pregnant. But, you know, society was very stark in its belief in that. However, the interesting thing is, you know, and with history there are always these contradictions, working class women and working class men, working class society in general, lived by different sets of rules. And so, for example, there were a lot of people who lived together who weren't married, and society tended to turn a blind eye to it. However, when it wanted to, it came down very hard on women. So women were punished for having children outside of wedlock by the social structures and by the establishment.
So what would Whitechapel have looked like around 1888? Can you explain what it would have been like for these women living there?
Well, Whitechapel itself, I mean, it's really important to remember, was just one of many slums in London. So people have this belief that somehow Whitechapel was the only place you could go if you were down on your luck, which is completely untrue. And there were slums throughout London. There were slums in places around, well, St Pancras, for example, Westminster and Chelsea, parts of those areas, which we imagine to be, you know, quite exclusive today, were known for their slums. Places like Bermondsey, Lambeth, Poplar, really all over London, parts of Soho. So you didn't necessarily have to go to Whitechapel if you were poor. However, Whitechapel became quite notorious. It's also worth mentioning that Whitechapel wasn't just a sink of iniquity. You know, in all of these places, you had people like shopkeepers, pawn shopkeepers, grocers, people, you know, of the middle classes who lived in these areas too. But often what slums amounted to were several very bad streets, which formed a type of nexus in an area. So Whitechapel was pretty bad in that there were a handful of streets which were just filled with lodging houses and what were called furnished rooms. And these were just single rooms where entire families could live, you know, a room of 8 by 10 feet, for example, you know, with extremely bad furnishings, vermin-filled, smoking chimneys, broken windows, no fresh running water, so people using wastewater, high levels of disease, starvation, vast amounts of social problems. And this is what you would find in Whitechapel, and Whitechapel became one of the most notorious places of deprivation.
So you mentioned these women came from, some of them, completely opposite backgrounds. What did you find so surprising when you began to research them? Because I think there are so many preconceptions about the women who were killed by Jack the Ripper that you've proved otherwise. What did you find the most surprising?
Well, what I found most surprising about them, well, I mean, there were many things I found most surprising, but, you know, obviously the banner headline here is the majority of these women. There is no evidence in 3 of the 5 cases that they ever were involved in sex work. And when I say no evidence, I mean no credible evidence. You know, for example, we have witness statements that don't actually appear in documents other than 2 cases, no official documents. For each of these women exist, and because of that we are reliant upon newspaper articles which give summaries of what was said at their inquests into their deaths, and that's really where we get the body of most information about who they were from. And the witnesses are unreliable. I mean, we just have no way of verifying what the witnesses were saying were true, if they actually knew the women or anything like that. And, you know, also one has to take with a pinch of salt what police say. You know, so here, you know, something which is quite interesting is, you know, when the police were writing up the paperwork when the bodies were found. So, for example, like Polly Nichols, and you know, you've got a little bit you've got a line that says name and a line that says you know, last place of residence, and a line that says occupation. Now, on the line that says occupation, police officer has written in prostitute. Well, most women who were living, you know, without a husband, without a spouse, without a father, without a home, found on the street late at night, you know, just even a single woman walking late at night was considered a prostitute. However, the year before, in 1887, there was a very famous case, the case of Elizabeth Cass, who was a seamstress, and she'd gone for a walk down Regent Street, where it was known that there was a lot of prostitution. And she had her collar felt by a constable, and then she was brought to trial for prostitution, and it was, you know... Her employer came forward and said, this is absolutely unfounded, she works for me, and lots of people came forward with character witnesses, and it turned out that she wasn't. And so as a result of this, the law had to be changed. So in 1887, police regulations were put into force, which said a police officer cannot identify a woman as being a prostitute unless she self-identifies as one. Or unless someone, a man, comes forward at that very moment to the police officer when the woman is there and said, that woman has just solicited me. And so you can see a year later, there's a body lying, you know, in the street, and the woman had been out late at night. She was a known alcoholic, and she didn't, you know, she didn't have anywhere to live other than a lodging house, which was a very disreputable place. And the police officer is going to write prostitute in the bit that says occupation. But by law, by definition, he cannot call her that, because she has not identified herself as such. So again, you know, this is a way in which we analyze documents, the way in which we look at documents and try to understand what they're saying. Also, it's important to mention that in all of the death certificates that were drawn up after the inquests are where we heard all of the evidence concerning these women's deaths, and we learned as much as we could about their circumstances, and the official decision was that they were not prostitutes, because occupation on the death certificate did not say that. However, it did in the case of Mary Jane Kelly, who was known, who left a large trail of evidence to support the theory that she was involved in sex work. And so, you know, this is very important. And again, this theory, what I have written in the book, is the one thing that has really stuck in the throats of a lot of so-called Jack the Ripper experts, who are not historians, who do not have the knowledge that historians possess of how to contextualize documents, but seem to take things on face value.
So how did the press treat the women initially in the wake of these murders?
Well, I mean, the press were, I mean, it was a mixture, really, of pity and, you know, and horror as well, and also sensationalism. And, you know, if you want to sell newspapers, if it bleeds, it leads. And this was a fantastic story for newspapers, because it was a murder mystery, and there had never been anything like it before. This was the first serial killer on the loose. Jack the Ripper seemed to be so good at what he did that he didn't seem to leave any trace. Nobody had any idea who he was. He had the police running in circles around themselves, and people were terrified. You know, what could make a better news story than that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And I think I wanted to actually read a passage from your book, because I think it ties in all of those things together. The idea of the press, the idea that this was sensationalist, But also the fact that they're not, you know, that you prove that they weren't actually just prostitutes. And you do actually, in your conclusion, which is titled Just Prostitutes, you do talk about this. And so I just wanted to, read this particular section because I think that it embodies what you're saying.
Okay.
The truth of these women's lives was not simple. And then sensationalist 19th century press was certainly not in the business of telling the whole story. Nor did any of the editors or the journalists covering this story deem it necessary or worthy of interest to delve with any depth into the victims' biographies. Ultimately, no one really cared about who they were or how they ended up in Whitechapel. The cards were stacked against Polly, Annie, Elizabeth, Kate and Mary Jane from the day of their births. They began their lives in deficit. Not only were most of them born into working-class families, but they were born female. Now, I think, what do you think this says? You know, the way that these women were treated posthumously then and now, what do you think this says about the way history and historians have treated women's lives and their stories? And the fact that, you know, the fact that we have continued to accept that narrative?
Well, I mean, it says a lot about us, and it says a lot about our ingrained attitudes towards women. You know, I think it's taken a lot of time for us to shake off these beliefs. You know, for example, the idea that if a woman is out alone by herself at night, you know, she's not a quote-unquote decent woman. And that, I mean, we're still living with that. We are still, you know, we still blame rape victims for getting raped. We still, you know, we still are so willing to think that the woman has done something to incur, you know, a rape or a murder. It's extraordinary. I mean, for example, also, you know, not that long ago, roughly, well, just under 100 years later, the Yorkshire Ripper was killing women, and the police believed he was killing quote-unquote prostitutes. And it was only when a decent girl, a normal girl, was killed that, you know, everybody got upset about this. I mean, it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary that in the 21st century, you know, the case of the Suffolk Strangler, that the judge, in the summing up for that, felt he had to tell the jury that they must be absolutely certain to drop their prejudices before coming to their conclusion about guilt, because, and quote, it didn't matter what these women's lifestyles were, what drugs they took, what they did, they didn't have the right to kill them. Nobody has the right to kill another person. But the fact that that has to be put out there really shows that we have a very long way to go as a society. And also, I think, you know, if you go back through history, you know, it's extraordinary how women's lives have been written about. Again, you know, there's this desire to paint women in, you know, either a very pure light or a very kind of, isn't she fun and bawdy and, you know, slightly evil? You know, you think of any women, you know, you think of, you know, Queen Victoria, you know, the way she is regarded. And, you know, some people are quite surprised to find that as a young woman, you know, she was full of all sorts of passionate urges, and she was, you know, a young woman full of life. And I think, you know, that's fairly new that we're starting to accept that as a society. And I think we want our idols to be very pure. We want to be hero worshippers, and that's extremely unhealthy for us. And women really kind of bear the brunt of this still, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's no room for nuance in a woman's character and the study of women. They're very binary, and as you say, they're either, you know, whores and concubines and she-wolves, as is another one that's used,
yeah.
or they are pious and gentle and kind.
Well, exactly. And it's interesting. I mean, we do have to think about, you know, how women have been written about in the past by male chroniclers, you know, and in female queens, for example, you know, the way they've been discussed, you know, and we have to weigh that up against the realities. And I think it's quite hard to get to know female subjects if the only people who have written about them in the past are men, and we must always think about that. We've just swallowed this stuff wholesale, you know, in history books about how kind of scheming and you know, I'm thinking about the Borgias, for example, and the Medicis, and you know, and I think we have to start looking at these figures with much more balance than we have until now.
No, I completely agree. And something I really wanted to ask you in relation to exactly that is, with your experience, especially in digging into the lives of these women, how can we apply those research methods to understand women's lives when history has been dictated and written for so many years by the patriarchy?
I know, it's quite difficult. I mean, I think documents are quite useful, but again, you know, documents contain biases. We know that. I think it's important to think about, obviously, context, always to think about who is recording whatever it is that appears on the paper, to weigh it up against the common beliefs about women at that time and what we know about human behavior. I mean, I think, again, this is something which is not talked about very much in the process of history writing, which is, you know, looking at how human beings behave, you know, the psychology of human beings, you know, where there may not be actual documents that tell us what has happened. For example, how are people likely to behave when they are in a position where they have to survive? How are people likely to be thinking when, you know, five of their children have died? What's going on inside the person? And I think it's really not outside the realm of history to really start considering that and taking those aspects of another discipline into consideration when we're examining people from the past.
No, I completely agree. I mean, human emotion, yes, it has changed and evolved and developed over time and experience, but it's the same thing. It's those same fundamental core psychological principles, isn't it?
It is, but also, you know, one has to be very, very aware of, you know, this is where social history comes in, because one has to be very, very aware of what the context is at that time and how people were likely to believe and how they regarded things like infant death and how they regarded things like, you know, one's physical body and sex. And we always have to separate out what our modern default settings are and just always be aware of that. But also, you know, we do have psychology to fall back on, and there are certain things that human beings tend to do in certain circumstances.
I think I could talk to you about that for hours, but we're not going to do that. So, Hallie, you've done the most fantastic job at liberating these women from the clutches and of the cult of Jack the Ripper, which is a misogynistic cult that has gone on far too long without intervention. How would you like these women to now be remembered and this story to be told subsequently?
Well, I think what I want and what I see happening, and again, you know, it's going to be a slow drip, and it's not going to happen necessarily overnight, but I would really like their stories to be reintegrated into the quote-unquote story of Jack the Ripper. Once you learn these women's stories, once you know who they are, once you understand them, it's very hard just to keep your focus exclusively on Jack the Ripper and naming the killer and the hunt for him and all of these other things, because you realize that these people are real human beings, and that's incredibly important. And so I'm hoping that with time that will actually really change our narrative about Jack the Ripper.
I completely agree, and I think that's important. I think that history is human, and that needs to be remembered.
Absolutely.
with these subjects. Hallie, thank you so much for talking to me about this. I know that you've been so busy and you've had so much publicity surrounding this book, so I really appreciate your time. What are you working on next? It feels like this is a huge thing to follow up on, but I'm sure you will with force.
Yeah, well, I mean, I found that And, you know, true crime is a really interesting field, and historical true crime is interesting, but turning the lens around on true crime, I think, is something which needs to be done much more often, and that's what I'm going to be doing with my next book, because I'm looking at the murder of Belle Elmore by Dr. Crippen in 1910. And the interesting thing about that is, if you remove Crippen from the story, this is a story populated almost exclusively by women. And it's a story about Belle, who he killed, who was a music hall singer, and who had this enormous group of friends who were a proto-union called the Music Hall Ladies Guild, and how they tried to bring Crippen to justice. But also it's a story about Crippen's receptionist or his assistant, Ethel Deneuve, who he ran off with and who she was, and also about Crippen's first wife, who was a nurse from Ireland, who he met in the United States. And the Crippens, both Crippen and Belle, were both American. So the story is a transatlantic story. And it also looks at femicide, and it looks at violence against women and how women's stories have been kind of written out of the canon of true crime historically, because true crime stories, certainly in the past, have very much gone along the lines of, this is a story about male heroes who apprehend male villains and make society good again. And the women in this particular story have been, you know, their experiences and their involvement have been written out. So I'm going to be looking at it from that aspect.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I think it will certainly be following. I think it will certainly be following the five in level of detail and interest and intrigue.
Absolutely.
So, how can people see what you're doing at the moment? Are there any online festivals and things that you're going to be working
on?
Yeah,
well, there will be coming up the Hay Festival, which is going to be all digital this year, and I'm doing an event with Lisa Tadeo, who wrote Three Women, and I'm going to be talking about the five, so effectively eight women, about women's experiences past and present, and that's going to be on the 30th of May, and you can go to the Hay Festival website to find out more about that. And also I'm doing something called a Wigtown Wednesday, and the Wigtown Literary Festival again is going digital. And I believe that is going to be, I think it's the 5th of June, but I'm not sure. Please have a look at the Wigtown Festival website. And those are two events I have coming up for the moment.
And you're on Twitter as well, so you will let, yeah, so you can be followed on there too. Oh, well, thank you so much, Hallie, and I really hope that you can get into the archives again soon so you can.
Oh, me too.
So you can get back into your research. Thank you so much, and I hope to have you again on for a third time.
Well, you're very welcome, Helen, and I look forward to it.